will say that Karl Rove is a senior advisor to the President of the United States, the most successful Republican strategist since Henry Stimson. No, since when? Since, Admiral Stuart got Lincoln elected. Who knows? And he's a great student of history. In fact, he helped write the Time magazine cover on Teddy Roosevelt 3 weeks ago. He's and one of the quotes you have in that Lessons of Teddy Roosevelt piece you did is the United States is a profound force for good in this world. That's a lesson from Teddy Roosevelt. We're now faced with a situation where what started off as a liberation of Iraq has become kind of a messy occupation. And I was wondering if you could talk to us about how we might regain the moral high ground and be known around the world as a force for good.
I'm not certain we've lost the moral high ground. I mean, we've liberated in Afghanistan and Iraq 50 million people, given both countries an opportunity for democracy that they've never had before. And the creation of democracy is never easy. The piece that I wrote for Time, which incidentally I have a greater respect for people who are journalists now because I made the mistake of saying yes before I knew all the details. They said we'd like 800 words on Theodore Roosevelt for the July 4th issue, and this is like the 28th of June. And I thought, geez, that gives me a week and a half to write 800 words. And I said, sure, I'd be happy to try my hand at that. They said, great, can we have them tomorrow? So I wrote about Theodore Roosevelt. And remember, in the time that he was reelected, 1904, we were fighting a guerrilla war in the Philippines with the Moros, and it took 30-some-odd years to create a functioning democracy in the Philippines. I don't think it'll take that long in Iraq, but it is vital work, and I think that we are seen as people who have not come to occupy, not to take oil, not for the purpose of securing oil supplies, but for the purpose of removing a threat to us and providing people a chance to live in freedom and democracy.
And you see a path to success?
Well, yes. I mean, and if we couldn't see a path for success, we shouldn't be there. And the path is to help the Iraqis stand up their security forces so that they can, over time, defend themselves. It's to work with them in reconstruction so that they have a functioning economy and a civil society that can sustain itself. And it is to help them develop ties with their neighbors in the region that allow them to sustain themselves against outside threat. And it is a constant, I mean, the big purposes, the big elements, if you will, of that strategy remain constant, but there's also been, you know, sort of like consistency in goal, but flexibility in method, because throughout the last several years, we've constantly had to evaluate what's happening on the ground and to adjust accordingly. In fact, that's one of the most remarkable things about both our military and civilian leadership in Iraq, General Casey, General Abizaid, Ambassador Khalilzad, is that they've been constantly thinking through what's happening and what needs to be adjusted. Let me give you just one example, not to dwell too much on it, but for example, on reconstruction assistance, at the beginning, our theory was build big projects. And those turned out to be so remote in their execution and so large in their activity that they just provided useful targets for the enemy to strike while providing no immediate tangible benefit to the people of Iraq. So instead, we shifted for a period of time to providing, when there was no local government, we provided assistance through the local commanders on the field. The local commander in a particular town could say, what the town leaders, the local sheikh, the town elders tell me they need is a well or a sewage improvement or a new school, and they had the ability to take money and provide it to the local community to arrange for that kind of assistance. As the government has come into place in each of these provinces and in the major cities, we've moved to what are called provincial reconstruction teams, where we have experts, civilian and military, who work with the local governments. So the local government, in a democratic expression, determines that what it needs is X, Y, and Z, and then we work with the central government in Baghdad and with U.S. Assistance and with NGOs then to provide them the wherewithal to execute those kind of projects.
That's an interesting lesson. I was wondering if there are other lessons we may have learned from some of the difficulties that we can apply the next time or even in Iraq or the next time we have such a situation.
Well, there are lots, and you know, whether it's the security situation, initially our thought was to go in and clear an area out and think that the local Iraqis would be able to sustain the security situation, that turned out not to be the case. In fact, what we found was that Mosul, for example, we went in, cleaned it out, and 6 months later it was back in the same condition it was before. So we had to change the strategy from one of clearing things out to clearing, holding, and building, so that the object was take a smaller number of targets on, but clear them out, hold them with U.S. troops and coalition troops while the Iraqis were built up to the point where the Iraqis could take control of the security situation and then move on from there. And, you know, it's I have a cousin who's gone there on three tours of duty with the 82nd Airborne. And the first time he went there, they cleaned out Mosul. Before he left the first time, they cleaned it out again. When he came back the second time, Mosul was part of the build, hold, the build, the clear, build, and hold. And what had happened was he said it was an entirely different place than his previous two times in town.
That leads to the conclusion that we probably should have had more troops in the first round.
No, I'm not certain that's where it leads. It may lead that we may have should have made a different decision about disbanding the Iraqi military,
right,
and about the Iraqi security forces.
Mm-hmm. By the way, you said just a moment ago, here's the path to success. And it was a pretty tall order. It had civil society, everything else in it. And you said, and if we can't do that, we shouldn't be there. Was that a rhetorical statement, or do you think it's possible that maybe we shouldn't be there if we can't fulfill that tall order?
We can do those things. It won't be perfect. It won't be, you know, it's not going to be U.S. style. It's not going to be, you know, it's not going to be, you know, sort of a bucolic Midwestern, you know, small town atmosphere. It's going to be Iraq,
yeah,
with some very deeply felt sectarian strains, with you know, bad guys and people with lots of guns. But it is going to be a functioning society that is going to be, and already is, a distinct improvement upon the society that existed before.
In the past week, General Powell was here, Senator McCain was here, and they both said, close Gitmo.
I think I know that's the president's attitude. He'd like to, but the question is, and do what? We've been waiting for several years now for this court decision that we now have, Hamdan, which gives us not a clear path of what the court would find acceptable, but it gives us some guidance as to what the court would find acceptable. But when we close Gitmo, the question is, what do you do with the bad guys at Gitmo? Do you send them to Florence, Colorado, and put them in the U.S. criminal justice system? Do you send them to the brig, the Navy brig in Charleston, South Carolina, and put them in the military justice system? What do you do with them?
But that's my question.
Well, and frankly, that's been our question, too, because we've had two court decisions. One court decision, the Hamdi decision, could we even hold these people? And the Supreme Court said yes. And then Hamdan, which now says, and Justice Breyer sitting over here, couldn't you be more
He's
explicit told next
us
time?
What it said. Sorry, what was that?
Leave out the foreign stuff, U.S. code, but give us a little bit more clarity next time. But we'll be turning to people like Harmon Collins here to help work out what that'll be. But we will have to find, you know, it's not like World War II. We had enemy combatants that we picked up on the battlefield, and we shipped them off to, you know, camps in Arizona and Utah and Nevada and kept the Nazis there until the end of World War II, and most of them went home. But this is not the same kind of war. These people don't wear uniforms. They're not signatories to the Geneva Convention. They're not governed by their own code of military conduct. They're bad guys we swept up on a battlefield somewhere. And as a result, we're having to use old institutions for new circumstances, and that's always a problem for a democracy.
But you couldn't just say, all right, let's close it. The president wants to close it. Here's a solution.
We want to close it, but we want to, you know, we've been respectful of the court as these cases wound their way through the courts to say, let's listen for what the court has done. We hoped that they would move a little bit quicker than they have, but they've moved, and we've now got an opportunity to work with Congress to arrive at a solution that will help deal with these new circumstances we find ourselves in.
Justice Breyer just shrugged in apology for not moving more quickly.
I wasn't being critical. I'm respectful of the separation of powers here. I mean,
I'm going to give you another quote.
Can't give me a fine or a ticket for having suggested you move faster. I'm not in acting in contempt. Are you in your official capacity here? I just want to make certain.
Another quote from your Teddy Roosevelt article was that a spirited clash of ideas is not only inevitable in politics, but helpful. One of the things at our Ideas Festival is that perhaps there's been not just too much spirit in the clash, but that we become so divisive in the way we clash these days. Do you see that?
I do. I don't think it's a recent phenomenon. We see this periodically through American politics. You go back and read what was said in the 1800 campaign by all the candidates for president, and you know, you'd think Newt Gingrich was one of their speechwriters. I mean, it's pretty ugly stuff. But we're at a point where we're at the, I hope the final stages of a 10 or 12 year run where politics has been particularly ugly. I go back and I read the things that were said from the White House podium in the 90s and compare them what are said, were said on the other end of the avenue from the senatorial and congressional leadership during the same time, and it's pretty vicious personal stuff. And I would challenge anybody to go read the comments made by this president in his public appearances, in his news conference, or in, made by a spokesman from the podium in the White House, and you'll find none of the same kind of heated personal vindictive rhetoric. And that's deliberate. And I'm a hothead, I admit it. And so when I see some of these things, when, you know, the leader of the Senate Democrats comes out and says the president is a liar, when we know that's absolutely not true, I get a little hot. But the president says, I can tell Harry Reid has a few advocates here. Hope you'll line up behind the questioning. You know, this is where American politics is, though. And you know, we can have a spirited disagreement about where people are on the issues, and that's fair and that's productive. That's what democracy is about. But it strikes me when the first imperative of the of somebody is to set up a war room and to hire a bunch of people to figure out how they can go, you know, personally trash the people on the other side, that's not constructive.
But people talked about either you or people who worked with you, Republican operatives, trashing Max Cleland for lacking patriotism. And hold on. And also when John McCain was here, he was pained, and so was his wife, sure, about what happened in South Carolina and some of the really hard.
Let's talk about both of those. First of all, contrary to the suggestions, which the myth-making of Washington, D.C., I didn't run the Saxby-Chambliss campaign. But I will say this. Look at the context. Max Cleland's running a TV ad saying that he supports the president on the Homeland Security bill, which was demonstrably false. He voted consistently against the president's position on the Homeland Security bill. But he ran a television ad in which he pictured himself and the president in an attempt to use the president's popularity in Georgia as a way to get reelected. Saxby Chambliss ran an ad that began with pictures of Al-Qaeda and said we're in a war on terror, and then recited 11 votes where Senator Cleland had voted opposite the Bush administration on national security issues. Now, we can make an argument, and I accept that it's fair to make an argument as to whether or not he should have included footage of that alluded to the war on terror there, but the argument was not that Max Cleland was unpatriotic. It was that he had voted opposite the administration on 11 separate occasions, was not supportive of the administration on the Homeland Security bill, and had voted 11 different times. Now, Senator Cleland responded in the following fashion. You're attacking my patriotism. You're attacking a war hero, which was not what Saxby Chambliss was doing. He was saying, I disagree with you. I voted this way on 11 issues. You voted that way. Who's supporting the president in the global war on terror? Now, that's, you know, I frankly have never seen the ad. I've read the transcript of the ad, but I've never seen the ad. That, to me, though, strikes me as fair and reasonable. Now, McCain in the primary in South Carolina. Now, look, make up your minds. I'm either a genius or I'm an idiot. Does it make sense in the South Carolina Republican primary? I had to deal with this for 19 days because there were lots of lunatics running around South Carolina. We had an event in which we had a bunch of veterans endorse the president. And we had a guy stand up there and endorsing the president attack Senator McCain for his performance in Vietnam. Does anybody in this room think that was helpful to the candidacy of George Bush or hurtful to the candidacy of John McCain? No, it put us on the defensive. There was some nut professor at Bob Jones who started circulating things attacking John and Cindy McCain's adoption of an Asian child. This was an incredibly compassionate and warm act on their part. Does anybody think that kind of attack helped George W. Bush or hurt Senator McCain? I spent 19 days trying to keep people from saying bad things about John McCain. McCain had given us an opening. He ran a television ad saying, quote, George W. Bush doesn't tell the truth just like Bill Clinton. So he gave us a great opening. In attacking somebody as being Bill Clinton in the Republican primary in South Carolina in 2000 was not exactly the best way to ingratiate yourself with Republican primary voters, and we made the most of it. Well, the television ad said that that was beyond the pale. But anybody who thinks that we thought that it was constructive to go out and personally slam an American hero, particularly for an act of incredible generosity and graciousness and warmth and love on his part, is kidding themselves. Now, 19 days I spent literally calling people who might be inclined to say ugly things about McCain, one of whom was Pat Robertson, and trying to talk him out of doing stupid things. And, of course, we did talk him out of doing stupid things in South Carolina. But he repaid us by, immediately after the Tuesday primary in South Carolina on the 19th of February, beginning to run radio ads in Michigan saying all the things that we didn't want him to say in South Carolina and had gotten his commitment that he would not say. And he ran them in Michigan. And, of course, we lost the Michigan primary. I mean, you win races not by attacking your opponent on things that people consider to be fundamentally unfair and below the belt.
Thank you. One of the things that ends up being divisive, potentially, is when right before elections, certain issues get brought up for a vote that seem mainly for political posturing as opposed to really substance. You know, gay marriage, flag amendments, that type of thing. Why does that keep coming up right before each election?
Well, part of it is like on the flag burning amendment, the main sponsor of this is the American Legion, which has got a huge number of veteran service organizations and other private groups behind it. And they realize that when you come in into an election year, members of Congress and members of state legislatures are more inclined to be sensitive to people making arguments on behalf of their issues. So, of course, you'd expect them to bring it up in an election year because that gives them the maximum amount of leverage. Flag-burning amendment, for example, every single legislature in the country has passed a resolution supporting the flag amendment. The last state to do so was Vermont. But every state has done so. So, of course, when it comes around to an election year, they're going to try and get the maximum effort they can to get it passed and bring it up.
There are other issues that some of us thought you'd be pushing more, such as new ideas on schools, vouchers, that sort of thing. Why has that not been at the fore of this term?
Yeah, let me come back to it. Can I finish the other one about gay marriage for just a minute? I want you to remember how the gay marriage issue intruded into American politics. This intruded into American politics when gay rights groups used their constitutional right to avail themselves of the courts and to go into court in Arizona, Nebraska, Indiana, New Jersey, Massachusetts, and I believe several other states, in order to gain acceptance of same-sex marriages. They had a right to do so. When they got the Massachusetts Superior Judicial Court, to, on a 4-3 decision, legitimize same-sex marriages in Massachusetts, that's when this intruded on the national political agenda. Now, I know that it's an unpopular thing in some quarters to say, but this issue was forced into the dialogue not by the advocates of traditional marriage, but by the advocates of same-sex marriage. Now, what has happened since then is that we've had 19 state referendums. We'll have 13 more this year. Every one of those referendums has passed a referendum in favor of a constitutional provision or a statutory provision defining marriage as a union between one man and one woman. I suspect every one that's held this year will similarly pass. The closest was Oregon, which was 56-44. Overall, they've passed by a cumulative vote of better than 2-1. And this is an issue that is not as easily put off in little boxes. 40% of the people in Ohio who voted for John Kerry voted for the statewide referenda in favor of traditional definition of marriage. This is an issue about which people have deeply felt convictions and which does not run in the normal channels. Now about charters and vouchers. Look, we're strongly for charters and vouchers. We have a $250 million fund to help states and localities plan for charters. But education is principally a local function. We put 7% of the cost of public education is paid for by the federal government. So this president believes, as a conservative and as a federalist, that it is up to states and local governments to take the lead in making decisions about charters and vouchers. We'll provide the assistance, in terms of best practices and grants to get things going. But a state has got to make a decision as to charters and vouchers. We have supported it in the District of Columbia, for which there is a federal responsibility, and it's been enormously powerful in improving the schools in Washington, D.C. We believe in charters and vouchers. In Texas, when he was governor, we expanded charters in a pretty dramatic fashion, particularly in communities for at-risk kids, because the then Governor Bush was enormously concerned about the tendency of, look, the biggest in a junior high or a high school, one of the biggest determinants of whether or not children learn is whether or not they have a safe classroom. And the disruptive student is the biggest threat to a safe classroom. But what we tended to do, not what we tended to do, what we did was we took the kid who was disruptive and threw him out and said, best of luck to you. And the Governor Bush, as a candidate, said, this is not good enough. Every child deserves to read. Every child deserves to learn. Every child is a valuable person and deserves respect. And so he particularly put an emphasis on charter schools as alternative academies for junior high and high school kids who could not function in the normal school system. And it was one of the most powerful experiments, because it didn't just happen in places like Dallas, Houston, and Austin. I mean, in Lubbock, they set up an alternative school for kids who in the area schools in far west Texas were having difficulty, and it had a huge change in kids' attitudes. Kids who would normally be expected to drop out and disappear and suffer all kinds of bad things suddenly found themselves graduating from high school and going on to community college or going on to college or going to work in a way that was simply impossible for them before we began the charter experiment for alternative education.
And you feel you've done enough on this?
We'd like to see more done. I mean, right now our principal focus is on No Child Left Behind and making certain that has depth, structure, and force for the future. We then want to expand No Child Left Behind. I want you to think about this. No Child Left Behind has now been in existence for 5 years. What it says is that every child deserves to learn to read, and that the best way that we can make certain that children learn to read is that we'll test every child grades 3 through 8 on whether or not they're learning to read and whether they're learning math and science. And if they're failing to learn to read, we will give additional assistance to the school to be able to give that child a leg up. The NAEP, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, this is a well-received, accepted measurement of student progress, has now been in existence for 33 years. The gains in reading in the last 5 years are greater than the gains in reading in the previous 28, and particularly strong gains for African Americans and Latinos, who are going to be the principal beneficiaries of a accountability system that says we're going to measure every child and we're going to disaggregate the data. We've always measured children, but what we've done is we've said, okay, we're going to take our success in teaching the nice white suburban kids. We're going to use our success there to hide our failure to teach kids in inner city schools, kids who come from a home where English is not their first language, or kids in poor communities. And what we've done in No Child Left Behind is to say we're going to disaggregate the data so that we know how every child is learning to read. Because if you empower a parent with information, there's no more powerful force in the universe than a parent who wants the best thing for their child. And by providing parents with the tools to understand whether or not their children are learning to read, we're creating a giant force for reform of local
institutions. But it doesn't do much good if the parent doesn't have school choice.
Well, that's right, and that's why we built to the extent that we could in No Child Left Behind public school choice under No Child Left Behind. And this doesn't help in places like New Orleans, where there are not a lot of good public schools that you can go to, or the District of Columbia. I live by coincidence in one of the neighborhoods in the District of Columbia. There are like 2 or 3 elementary schools which are considered public elementary schools which are considered to be acceptable or good. And it's really interesting because there's this particular one is the Key Elementary School. South of the Key Elementary School, there's like a long block, like a block and a half of duplexes. And what's interesting is people will buy one of those duplexes when their child is approaching kindergarten, and when they're approaching the end of their elementary school career, they'll sell it and either move to the suburbs or God knows what, but they're gone. And it's a whole block. And because you go there and there'd be 3 or 4 every spring, 3 or 4 houses for sale or something.
Yeah, but most people in Washington don't have that choice.
They don't have that choice. They're stuck in a school system that is a disaster. Hence what we've done with school charters in District of Columbia.
On global warming, let me ask you personally. Do you feel it's a growing, serious problem that we have to address, a man-made problem that requires some serious action? Or are you still unsure of the science?
The administration's view is that there has been global warming, that man-made activity has contributed to it. What we do not know is what that all means. We don't know how dangerous a problem it is, how much time we have. So as a result, the United States government under this administration is devoting more money to global science research than the rest of the world combined, $2 billion a year. Did not happen on other people's watch. It happened on ours. We're contributing $3 billion a year to the development of alternative technologies that will reduce greenhouse gas emissions. We're also doing something that I think is incredibly innovative and important, and that is we are investing in the reduction of greenhouse gases in the most cost-efficient way that we can, which is by providing technologies to developing countries. For example, we're partnering with the Indians on the development of the first zero-emissions coal plant in India, because India has vast coal reserves, and they are going to use them. And so how can we help establish a model in which, as their economy develops, their fuel efficiency improves as well, so they reduce their greenhouse gas emissions? And, it's one thing to talk about Kyoto. And we could have probably held hands and talked with people about Kyoto so that people felt better about it when we said we're not going to sign it. But look, Kyoto has failed. It did not work. Any regime which says, any attempt to deal with this problem that says we're not going to involve developing countries,
China and India
principally, but others as well, and we're going to use a false standard, 1990 emissions, and we're going to, in essence, penalize the American economy, which is driving the world economy, that's just the wrong way to go.
Can we get a Kyoto agreement that's better?
Well,
is it worth trying?
Well, we're engaged. We have bilateral agreements now with countries that are involved in that together produce 70% of the world's greenhouse gases. And those bilateral agreements are aimed at the things that I've been talking about. How do you mutual agreements on how do we increase energy efficiency? How do we reduce greenhouse gases? How do we exchange and share technologies in a way that helps particularly the developing countries deal with this in a positive way? And how do we back it with real money, which is exactly what the government's
doing. Let me get directly to oil, because dependency on oil distorts our foreign policy, it seems. I mean, in terms of how we can deal with everybody from Iran to Russia to Chavez. It contributes to global warming. And most of the oil goes to gasoline for transportation. Shouldn't we raise fuel efficiency standards seriously?
That's one way to go, but a better way to go, we think, is to invest in alternative technologies that will allow us to reduce our dependence on foreign sources of energy. And that's what we've been doing with spending $3 billion a year in energy technologies. Now, we had an interesting set of meetings last summer. We began a hydrogen car initiative, for example. We've got research into cellulosic ethanol. We've got research into battery technology. We've got research into plug-in batteries. We met with all the people at the Department of Energy who were involved in these projects, and they'd been involved, these projects had been moving for enough years that we were able to say to them, look, you have set previously a target for when you think this technology can be brought to market. Where are you, and what do you think can be done to bring it to market faster, and if so, how much more money are you going to need? And it was a really interesting set of meetings because, again, as a conservative, I'm a little skeptical of government bureaucrats. But these guys were incredibly smart and able. And they said, the hydrogen guys said, look, don't give us any more money and don't expect us to get it done any quicker. Come back about 2015 or 2016 and we may have some progress to report to you. But we're at the fundamental basic research and we can't move it up any faster. Thank you very much. But everybody else, cellulosic, battery, solar, wind, you name it, they all said, we've got enough of this so that we now know it's an engineering problem, not a basic research problem, and we can speed it up. And we can speed it up, and rather than getting it done in 2016, we can get it done in 2011. And rather than get it in 2015, we can get it done in 2010. Rather than getting it done in 2014, we can get it done in 2009. And every one of them said, we don't need more money. Just give us what you originally have planned in the budget over that time frame. Give it to us earlier. And get rid of the earmarks. For example, the cellulosic guys said 40% of the money that we have in this year's budget is earmarked, and it goes to projects which a member of Congress has deemed to be useful to their district, but which is not peer science reviewed, and we believe adds absolutely nothing to our ability to achieve this goal.
Were you able to do that?
Well, we're in the process now of trying to... We'll get
Harmon and Collins' vote. Those are the two we can get for you.
I'm not lobbying them directly, but I hope you do talk to them.
Nuclear energy, you didn't mention.
Nuclear is really important. We laid this out, the President laid it out in 2001 in the State of the Union address. He campaigned on it in 2000. What's been interesting to me is the change in the mindset of a lot of the green community, a recognition now that it is a, you know, zero emissions, problems that have to do with what to do about the waste that are more engineering and doable. And we've got to do it. And it's absolutely vital. Going back to cars, for example, with gasoline, one of the most interesting technologies is going to be battery technology. I know we've got Mr. Miles here who's got it.
Rubin has a little red electric car in front of the reception
center. Now, I'd prefer that you buy a quality U.S. product myself, but that's that's me. But, you know, it's what's interesting. We went to Johnson Controls in Milwaukee, which are one of the prime contractors on this, and they showed us the existing technology. And you open up the back of the SUV, and there is the giant pack. And, I mean, it takes up the whole cargo area of the SUV. And they said, that's the current technology. Here's the technology we're in the final stages of perfecting. And you open up the back of the SUV, and there's nothing. And they open up the carpet, and there underneath the carpet is a battery pack about this long, about this wide, about that deep, and it weighs 72 pounds. And it will get you 40 miles, which is about what the average American drives in a day. Now think about this. Think about having a battery pack in your car and cheap nuclear power. And you go at night, plug your car into the electricity grid powered by nuclear power, and that's what you drive for the first 40 miles the next day. This is now achievable. And in the energy bill, we have passed incentives for the development of the next generation of nuclear power plants. The French have got a standardized design so that, you know, when they want to build another power plant, they don't have to go through an expensive process of designing something. They got the proven design, plunk it down and build it. We're trying to do that here, so we've got incentives and assistance there. But also, and we help them with the insurance issue. And we're also going to help on the building of the first plant. But we're also, a lot of the private industry, the nuclear power industry, say, look, that's fine and good and that's helpful and that's useful. And we're happy to take whatever you can get us. But one of the big things that's an obstacle for us is the permitting process. We now do the permitting process in sort of a linear fashion where each step has to follow each other step, even though they are completely unconnected to each other. So instead what we're doing is we're putting a new process in place where we will process the permits as much as possible at the same time, so that the people who are looking at one part of the plant can look at their job at the same time that another group is looking at a different, you know, it's not the same people. It's not like we got one guy over there who's got to look at each one of these permits in order.
And we've a standardized design will
standardized design will help.
On stem cell research, the Senate has now reached some agreement to reopen debate, consider it. I think the last time I saw you in Aspen here, you were very forceful in holding the line on where the president came out, his 2001 compromise on stem cell. Do you think after 5 years, as a science warrants reopening the issue?
Well, there's going to be a vote here shortly in July, mid-July, on three bills. One bill is going to be a bill that would outlaw fetal farming, which would be the, you know, in essence, the creation of farms of embryos for the purpose of harvesting them for research. The second bill will be the Castle bill, which would overturn the president's August 2001 policy.
That's Mike Castle of Delaware?
Mike Castle of Delaware, okay. Former governor of Delaware.
A Republican, by the way. I mean, this is not a partisan issue.
Yeah. If it passes, it's passed the House previously. If it passes the Senate, the president said he will veto it. The third bill is a bill by Senator Santorum and Specter, which would provide money for research into other ways to derive embryonic stem cells that are not ethically troubling. The one thing that's happened in the last 4 or 5 years is that we have found that there are lots of ways now to create embryonic stem cells or to reprogram adult stem cells to act like embryonic stem cells that don't involve the destruction of human embryos. And this would allow for this kind of research.
And so the president won't veto the Specter bill?
The Specter Sandhorn bill, no.
Yeah. And even if it's, I mean, is there some leeway there on the science?
No, this does have, and look, again, I mean, there was so much promise about embryonic stem cell research. A lot of it was driven by the experiment in Korea that was held to hold such great promise. It turned out to be a complete and utter fraud. But there has been a lot of very positive research done that indicates there are ways to derive embryonic stem cells in ways that don't bear the ethically troubling dilemma of what you do about the destruction of a human embryo. Look, I don't know where life begins, but I do know this. Every one of us passed through that stage. Every one of us was that clump of cells that now resides in a fertility clinic someplace, or that would be created for the purpose of harvesting genetic material. And I think we ought to be very careful about being so callous as to treat life in that kind of fashion, that it's just material to be harvested for the current generation's health and well-being. There are ways to go about doing this, and we ought to do it. I would also say this. In the aftermath of the August 2001 decision, there are 22 lines that are available to any researcher. There are 700 batches of those lines that have been requested and delivered to experimenters. We've provided $90 million. This administration is the first administration to fund embryonic stem cell research. We've funded $90 million worth of research into those embryonic stem cell lines. We've done so because those lines are derived from embryos about the decision was already made prior to the president's decision. But the president meant what he said, and that is that if he is presented a bill that would overturn his policy, and that it involves the harvesting of human embryos for the purpose of research, he will veto it.
But I am hearing, if I'm listening correctly, because this is a subject that interests me a lot, that there is some leeway and give now that the science has changed.
Well, look, and we appointed a bioethics panel led by Leon Cass at the University of Chicago for the specific purpose of monitoring the advances in science defined to follow the science as it was occurring and the developments as they were being published, to see if there were ethically acceptable ways of creating embryonic stem cells for the purposes of research and regenerative therapy.
And so they have.
Yes, the absolutely.
When President Clinton was here a couple days ago, he said to ask you this. Actually, a couple of his questions. Go ahead.
Doesn't he have better things to do with his time?
That if his Rahm Emanuel, his political aide, somebody else in the White House, had been outing a CIA undercover agent in order to discredit her husband's analysis, you would be sending people to the, you know, Republicans to the floor of the House to demand impeachment. You would be playing this better politically than the Democrats have been able to play it against you. Why shouldn't they be out there saying, how could you have done this?
Well, first of all, they have been. If Rahm Emanuel were accused of what you said, of outing an agent's name for the purpose of discrediting his or her spouse's attacks on the administration, that's a serious charge, and it ought to be looked into. And if, after a careful and thoughtful and aggressive and thorough investigation, that charge was found to have some foundation, then Rahm Emanuel should be fired. But if, after a long and thorough and aggressive investigation, that was found not to be the case, then I suspect I would suggest to people that they honor the process and have confidence in the process and move on.
Yeah, but,
and I do mean long and thorough and
all
aggressive.
Right. But just between you, me, and 500 other people, I mean, don't you have some regrets on that? I was involved in that a little bit because I was, my affiliation with Time. That was not a pretty sight. Whether or not it was an intentional thing, that was a regrettable event, wasn't it?
Again,
I got one applause. Again,
yeah, right. If the charge were accurate, it would be more than regrettable. It'd be wrong.
No, I'm not talking about the charge. I'm talking about the fact that there was discussion of Valerie Plame from the White House. Wasn't that a mistake?
I'm going to leave that up. I'm going to respect the fact that there's an ongoing case on this. But I go back to the...
Hey.
There are a lot of thoughtful people at the Aspen Institute, aren't there?
You got applause, too. Handicap 2008 for us, then. You owe me that one now that you ducked the other one. Republicans first.
If you thought I was ducking then, wait until you hear this one. First of all, I'm focused on 2006.
And they'll be... Actually, start with 2006, Sam. What does it look like to you? And then I'm going to get you to 2008.
The Republicans will keep their majorities in the House and Senate.
And how will you keep the House majorities? Make it a national issue of national security? Make it a national issue of things like gay marriage? Or make it local issues on the economy?
Well, first of all, what matters even more than the issues is sort of the landscape. Incumbents don't tend to get defeated. Most incumbents tend to get reelected. In 1994, I think there were 38 Democrat open seats, of which Republicans carried 32. There are 18 Republican open seats this time. President Bush carried 16 of the 18 in 2004 by an average margin of 59-41 and lost two of them in 2004 by an average margin of 52-48. So right from the beginning, the landscape of incumbents who, unlike 1994, when Democrats could never contemplate losing, so they took it for granted, we've made certain that for the last year, the Republicans are ready for a tough election. We've had them work, we've worked systematically to make certain they have a plan, that they're executing the plan, that they've got adequate resources, that they have thought through the issues, that they've thought through how to get reelected, that they're doing what needs to be done. Second thing that helps us is that incumbents, if they do that, get reelected. Second thing that helps us is that we've minimized the number of open Republican seats. And third, look, every election is a mix of national and local issues. And the question is, how much is one and how much of the other? And in this election, if Republicans go on the offense on Iraq and say we were right to do what we did, we're right to stay there until we win, and there will be bad consequences if we leave before the job is done, then we will be just fine. And we literally, the White House, the RNC, the Congressional Committee, we meet frequently on this. I meet every week with Roy Blunt, every other week with Roy Blunt, and every other week with Tom Reynolds for 6:30 breakfast. And our staffs meet every week, several times a week, to work the problem. By the end of June, the Vice President and the President and the First Lady had already done more events on behalf of House candidates than they had done through most of the 2002 election cycle, and it was only the end of June.
You talk about how you mentioned just in passing, most congressional seats have now been redistricted so that they're pretty safe and nobody, yeah. Incumbents never get ousted. Isn't that a problem for those of us who feel that competitiveness and perhaps even having to... Yeah. Go to the center is good for American politics?
Yeah, I think it is. I don't know the way out, but I think it is a real problem because it tends to, this has become particularly acute because of the power of the microchip. I was involved in redistricting in Texas in 1981. We had a Republican governor of Texas. We'd had a brief period of time in Texas during which we didn't have a Republican governor, 114 years. And we elected one in 1978, and he was there for the 1981 redistricting. Now, we didn't have a particularly strong hand to play in redistricting because out of the 150 members of the Texas House of Representatives, we had 18 Republicans. And out of the 31 members of the Texas Senate, we had 6 Republicans. But nonetheless, we got a redistricting plan cobbled together that was reasonably fair. And I can remember, adding machines and... long yellow pads. Well, now, you can break things down using the power of the microchip. You can break things down to literally the block or the half a block level. And this has allowed us to gerrymander in a really powerful way that was not previously available. And both sides use it to their advantage.
Would you be willing to sort of push against gerrymandering if there was a movement to do so?
Yeah.
Anything you want? Let me try on. Thank you. Let me try on 2000.
Yeah, let me say one other thing, though. This is one in which everybody's hands are dirty, and nobody's hands are clean when we get out of this. Let me give you back to the case I know best, Texas. Texas was redistricted in 1991. We were getting something like 40-some-odd percent of the votes for the House of Representatives races in Texas, and we had less than a third of the seats were Republicans. In the 1991 redistricting, with Democrat governor, Democrat legislature, made that even worse. By 2001, we had There are 27 statewide elected officials in Texas. When I moved to Texas in 1977, there were no constitutional offices. So those 20, there were 29 at that point, plus two senators. So there are 31. We had one U.S. senator, 29 statewide constitutional offices, of which everyone was a Democrat. By 1998, we'd reduced the number of statewide offices to 27, and all 27 of them were Republicans. So we get around to redistricting in 2001 with a Republican governor, Republican House, Republican Senate. They cannot agree upon a plan because it gets locked up. It's drawn by the courts, and the courts draw the plan based on the 1991 redistricting. So despite the fact that by this time Republicans are getting in the mid to high 50s in the total number of votes cast for congressional candidates, we're getting a minority of the seats, about, I think, 42 or 43% of the seats. So the mid-decade redistricting that was engineered 2 years ago basically reflects now the percentage the Republicans are getting, the percentage slightly better than the percentage of seats that they get in the terms of the percentage of the vote. So nobody's hands look clean, though, in putting the situation to right.
No, but obviously both parties, it's in their interest to redistrict to keep themselves safe seats, and that's how how we could get out of this mess.
I think we ought to take Montana solution,
yeah,
which is make every state one congressional district, and then it doesn't matter. So
proportional representation will be like Italy by the end of it.
I was thinking of smaller states as sort of a G.K. Chesterton kind of local neighborhood.
We'll try it in Colorado here. Question of whether there's enough money in the budget for cargo security, port security came up, President Clinton and others.
With all due respect to the former president, I think he may have been misinformed by staff. First of all, the bill that he referenced, I'm pulling out the numbers here so I got them accurate, but the bill that he referenced
read the newspaper of all the questions Clinton was
actually my
ask
spies
you?
Within the AD. Okay. Who says the NSA is not doing well with that terror
right.
surveillance program thing? You know? Some of you have incidentally had some very interesting calls that you've made from Aspen. The bill that he said we opposed, we supported. There's two competing bills in the Senate, Harmon-Lundgren bill in the House, and then there are two bills in the Senate. We do have one issue, which is Harmon-Lundgren. Dan wants me to call it the Lundgren-Harmon, but I'm loyal to you, Jane. The Harmon-Lundgren bill sets up a specific grant program for ports. We already have two, the Container Security Initiative and then the Customs Trade. We also have a specific grant program for the radiation portal monitors for the ports. And then we have the Coast Guard's deep water. We're spending $1.29 billion this year on port security. We'd like to have whatever kind of port monies there are, though, in a bigger sort of targeted infrastructure. There's another $600 million off in that targeted infrastructure account. We'd like more of the money to be there so that, look, right today, we don't have the best technology for the radiation portal monitors. And that technology is going to be ready relatively soon, the next year or two. We'd like to have the flexibility so that when that becomes available and meets our technological needs, we can take money out of the targeted infrastructure and buy that. And if the next year it is some other kind of gizmo or device, then we can make the capital investment there. So we want the flexibility from that. But we issued a statement of administration principle saying we strongly backed the Harmon-Lundgren bill, or maybe it was the Lundgren-Harmon bill. I don't know. So.
On the estate tax, leaving aside family farms, which I'm sure...
No,
in business,
you cannot leave aside family farms.
Well, I'm sure somebody as smart as you can figure out a way to get family farms to go down in businesses. Why is this a time to be repealing the estate tax?
For a couple reasons. First of all...
Where there are a few poor people in Aspen who are not going to benefit.
You, of course, are going to make no provisions to take your estate and put it into a trust or a foundation, are you? You're going to joyfully let your heirs write the 55% of it over to the government. Look, it is a moral wrong to tax something twice. And we tax that estate when it is built. And then we tax it again at death. I guess that's so you can't enjoy it when you're dead. And that's morally wrong to tax something twice. And
wait, why?
Because it's just wrong. Why tax?
But why it, morally wrong?
Because it is wrong to tax something twice.
I get tax on my income, and I get tax on sales tax. That's twice.
Yeah, you get a deduction in the for your sales tax expenditures,
yeah,
if you like.
Yeah.
So you're not taxed twice. And not only that, but look, it's fine. Look, with all due respect, the people who fly in and out of Aspen on your jets, I mean. You got accountants and smart legal guys who can help you construct your estates so that it has a de minimis impact on you. Good for you. I ran a small business, 18 people. Every year I had to write a $26,000 check for the insurance policy to pay the death taxes in the event of my death so my investors didn't have it paid out of the company. Now, I had 18 people. I could have paid them more money. I could have invested in a better piece of equipment. I could give them a better benefit. Now, you take this small business, and what about a medium-sized business that's family-run? I've seen this go with my grandfather started out literally in southern Colorado working on a road crew in the Depression selling knives off the back of a pickup truck to grocery stores in the San Juan Mountains. He never graduated from high school, but he built a business that even today employs my uncles and my cousins. And I know what the families had to go through twice to make provision to pay the death taxes when owners of the company, first him and then some of my uncles. Now, you know, it's fine for Warren Buffett to be able to give his money to the Gates Foundation and give each one of his children $1 billion for their foundations. I'm not worried about him, frankly. What I'm worried about is the land-rich, cash-poor farmer in Iowa. I'm worried about the family-run small business for whom taking 55% of the built-up value of the small business would absolutely mean shutting it down. I'm worried about a system that double taxes people who've went and spent their entire lives building something of value that's employed people and given people home and fulfilled a dream and who aren't able, because of where they are and who they are and what they're doing in their lives, to afford taking 55% of their estate and paying it to Uncle Sam when they've already paid taxes as they built up the value of that business. It is wrong, and we need to get rid of it.
Time Magazine this week's cover, since you didn't write it this week, is that on Teddy Roosevelt? Oh, it actually is on Teddy Roosevelt. Yes. It's called The End of Cowboy Diplomacy. And it's how the Bush administration's doctrine is now changing in the face of North Korea and Iran, with Dr. Rice, the Secretary of State, to a more realistic, as opposed to crusading, foreign policy. Do you see a shift as we deal with North Korea and Iran differently?
No, I don't. It'd be hard to make the argument that the crusading Colin Powell has been replaced by the realist Condi Rice. I think it has been a consistent philosophy, which is use every tool that is available in our arsenal, in our chest, if you will, to deal with these problems. And what we've been doing on Iran and North Korea for years has involved the kind of multilateralism that was complemented by the article in Time.
Let me ask you. If a Democratic administration were being this reticent and almost, soft on North Korea, just not doing anything, wouldn't you be attacking them?
I disagree with your assumption. We're not being soft on North Korea. North Korea is on the agenda because this president and this administration have put it on the international agenda. If we weren't talking about North Korea, the rest of the world wouldn't be paying any attention to it. If we had not labeled them part of the axis of evil, the rest of the world would be saying, very nice, Kim Jong-il, let's do what we can to buy you off. This administration has put it on the international agenda. And this administration has also pursued a consistent policy of attempting to get all the regional powers that have a stake in this to join in a common effort to restrain North Korea, because we tried bilateralism in 94 and 98, and it didn't work with North Korea. It just didn't. We also have been working with the Proliferation Security Initiative. We've recognized that the existing international institutions to stop proliferation of bad stuff and bad systems doesn't work. So we started the PSI, in which we said, look, everybody can do something. Join with us in helping to deal with the sources of proliferation. And that may mean you share intelligence. It may mean you share information about financing. It may mean you share information about the transit of individuals who have ties to these kind of things. It may mean that you're involved in helping do things like stop ships or board ships at your ports from North Korea to see if they have missile technology on it. It's one of the ways that we were able to uncover the AQ-Con network and the transfer of missile technology from North Korea to Libya. And as a result, the PSI, along with our actions in Iraq, led Libya to give up its weapons program. So we're involved in, and have been involved for a number of years in robust activities, now aimed at North Korea and Iran. Now, is it easier to do things when you're acting in concert with a small number of nations or by yourself? You bet. But we've made the conscious decision that having played the cards that we've played in the past, we played the card with North Korea of bilateral, and it didn't work. We used our sanctions on Iran in 1979, and as a result, that while they've had an impact, we've lost the ability to play that card. We've already played that. We've got to get others to play that card now with us.
Let me, Kitty loves this session so much, she agreed a week ago, even though she forgot, that we could go a little bit long, and the tutorials will start about 10 minutes late. And any questions from the audience? Sydney Harmon. And instead of having people come to the microphone, I'm going to point out that it'll probably keep speeches shorter. So, Sydney, just I'll repeat your question.
Carl, any question that anyone might have brought here as to whether you were genius or dummy, I think pretty well resolved this morning. In any event,
I buy quality Harmon products, incidentally. I've got, for my All you iPod, have to do I've is... got the excellent... In fact, Sydney sent me one, and because of the ethics rules, I had to send Sydney a check for it, but it was worth every penny of it.
He's billing us for our sound system, too.
Cash it, please.
Any man with your love of music cannot be all bad. In reflection on Walter's...
You'd be surprised.
...about American unilateralism, American triumphalism, which you answered quite directly, I would ask you, as you reflect on 6 years, is there anything at all on the domestic or the international front that you would think you would do differently?
Oh, sure. Lots. I'm not going to get into...
The question is, what would you do differently reflecting on 6 years of international and domestic decisions?
You're being polite. He said, is there anything... Did you think that you would do differently? And the answer is yes, lots. Lots. I mean, that's one of the things about being in government is you constantly have a chance to look at what has happened and say, something like that may happen again. What would we do differently? The interesting thing about Washington, though, is that Washington doesn't allow you to look at, examine, and move on. It requires you to engage in endless mea culpas in front of a news conference, and the president is reluctant to do that. He's done it several times, but it's not a comfortable feeling. But, yeah, there are lots of things we'd do differently, and we are trying to do things. We constantly, just like in Iraq when we have Zal and Khalilzad and Abizaid and Casey looking at things, we're charged with constantly having to look at things that we're doing and find different ways of doing things.
Gwen?
And then Laura.
Carl, I was surprised to hear you say a few minutes ago in answer to the stem cell question that you didn't know yourself where life begins. I think a lot of the evangelicals would be surprised to hear that. Could you elaborate on it?
I'm sorry, what did you say?
The question was, you said earlier that you didn't know where life begins, I think partly rhetorically. Evangelicals might be surprised to hear that. Could you elaborate on your doubts about where life might begin?
Well, look, I talk to a lot of evangelicals, and there many share, you know, look, how do you prove it? How do you prove it? Well, my thought is, and look, and my point I'm making is a lot of evangelicals share my concern about it. We don't know, but we do know that life begins, and that all of us that we come through that process, that we all begin the union of genetic material, and we all pass through those stages. And we couldn't be what we are as human beings unless we'd passed through those stages. And as a result, we ought to be very careful about being callous with regard to. I mean, I've said in some of these. We had some bioethicists come in and brief the president before his decision, and we had people on all different sides. And I frankly was a little taken aback by one fellow in particular, just a charming guy, wonderful guy, really delightful individual. But I was taken aback by the callousness with which he talked about embryos. And again, I don't know where life begins, but I do know we all once were that, and we ought to be very careful as a society in becoming callous or inured to the fact that we were once that.
Is Is that Laura? I can't tell. Yeah, Laura Listwood. It's lights are hard here. A subtle question, but it was on Karen Hughes's public diplomacy, and because our allies tend to be democracies and have their own electorate, some of whom go hot and cold on the United States, is that complicating our foreign policy?
Yeah. On the first one, I don't think Karen's work is going to be in a position to be judged for a good number of years. I mean, I see Ambassador Caddo down here in the early 80s and late 70s, we were involved in public diplomacy efforts. We face a much different world, and what we ought to be concerned with is the construction of new institutions and new methods that allow us to deal with the circumstances in which we find ourselves. And that's what the problem that Karen is grappling with. Some of the answers are easy because the answers are familiar. Yes, we ought to have a Farsi radio service broadcasting to Iran. Yes, we do need a more robust radio and if possible, satellite television service to the broader Middle East that allows us to penetrate as many of those societies as we can with clear and truthful information. But there are other issues with which she's grappling. How do we strengthen the hand of moderates within Islam, for example, where we're not going to be able to judge Karen's work until it's no longer Karen's work, but Karen's work and the work of her successors? And I know this is her mindset. She's looking for what are the institutional changes that we need, the institutional reforms that will allow us to confront the new world in which we find ourselves.
And did you, the democracy?
Oh, democracy. Look. Regimes, governments abroad which are allied with the United States, some of our friends and allies like Berlusconi fall. And some of them triumph, like Blair. Some of them lose, like Aznar, and some of them win, like Calderon. So, I think this is overstated for domestic purposes. And I wonder how much, in most instances, it's abroad. Howard, for example, who was obviously a clear and strong ally in Iraq and Afghanistan, won an unprecedented re-election. Harper in Alaska, or excuse me, in Canada, who's identified clearly as an ally of the United States, won an election where I'm not certain that his attitudes towards the United States really deeply figured one way or the other. I think it had to do with other things. So I'm careful not to read too much into some of those successes and careful not to read too much into the losses of some of our close friends.
Let me go over here. There's a gentleman in the back. Could you identify yourself? Because I can't see. The question was on the deficit rising, and of course you actually have the reports out today of some turnaround.
Yeah, well, there'll be the mid-session review will be issued on Tuesday morning. Our economy is the strongest of any major industrial economy in the world, and that's pretty remarkable given what we've gone through. When the president came into office, the economy entered a recession. The official date is in, I think, late February, early March of 2001, shortly after he took office in late January. We had corporate scandals that were uncovered under this administration that stretched back over the previous decade and prosecuted under this administration. And then we had 9/11, where two things happened. One, our economy was damaged. In the 90 days following 9/11, our economy shed 1 million jobs. And we also had a war that we entered, and the war has costs. Having said that, the president set the goal of reducing the deficit in half by 2009. We're going to announce this next week that we're going to achieve that well ahead of schedule. And in part, we've been able to achieve it because at a time when the economy was hurting, we cut taxes in 2001 and 2003. I want you to think about this. We cut taxes in 2003. And since then, the size of the American economy in 3 short years has grown 20%. That means that in the last 3 years, our economy has grown by a number bigger than the entire Chinese economy. We've created 4.5 million new jobs, more jobs than the entire EU combined. We have the fastest growth rate of any major industrialized country in the world. Our productivity numbers are at a 25-year high. Sure, we've got challenges. Our challenge is to manage the short-term deficit, which we will do by growing the economy and restraining spending. We have cut non-defense, non-homeland spending, the growth of it, every single year since this president came into office. The last administration, the FY01 budget, grew discretionary non-defense spending 15% in 1 year. We've cut that growth rate every year, and last year we proposed and Congress agreed to an absolute decline in the amount of money being spent on non-security, non-homeland spending, and we've asked them to do it again this year. That's really tough for Congress to do, as Harmon and Collins can tell you, but they did it last year, and we're confident they'll be able to do it this year. Our problem that the country faces economically is what to do about the entitlement costs. Now, I'm not the most articulate guy in the room on that. He's sitting in the second row, seat 4, next to John Doerr, and his wife's on the other side. But
Chairman Greenspan, for those who are craning their necks.
But we have a train wreck coming for our country, and our best advantage is that we got time to deal with it. And the problem is not that we have made promises that we can't afford today. It's that we've made promises that are going to grow faster than the economy, faster than inflation, and hence faster than our ability to pay for them. My mother-in-law gets the average Social Security benefit. She gets around $11,800 this year. My son, who's 17, is going off to college. Assume for a moment that he has an average career, which he won't have because he grew up in the moral equivalent of Lake Wobegon. But assume that he has the average career. I think most people would think that if they had a child who had an average career and got the average Social Security benefit, that when they retire, they would get $11,800 adjusted for inflation. Makes sense? Don't you think that's how Social Security grows? It grows at inflation? No, it doesn't. If he retires with the average benefit, when he retires, he'll receive $22,500 a year in today's dollars. Now, it grows at wages, but because of the way it's calculated, it actually grows faster than wages because you look at your fastest wage growth. So we've got a system that is growing faster than our ability to pay for it. And we got time to solve that problem. And we can do so by raising the age at which people retire. I thought the idea that was laid out by the president's committee, the so-called Posen formula, it said, okay, if you're at the bottom end of the economic ladder, we're going to raise your benefit by wages, basically the system we have today. If you're in the middle, we're going to raise your benefit by a measure of wages and inflation, so it's going to rise at a lower level than the guys in the bottom third. And if you're in the top third, we're going to have your benefit rise at inflation only. That solves 75% of the problem. Now, it may have made a little bit less money for John Doerr and Warren Buffett, because they're at the top end of the scale, but for the guy at the bottom, it kept him whole. And we got nowhere with it, nowhere. Now, we better, as a society, I hope, I'm obviously as a partisan believing we're going to keep the Republican House and the Republican Senate. If we do, I hope there is a moment in 2007 before everybody gets wrapped up in presidential politics where we can deal with Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security. Maybe we won't get the complete answer. Maybe we won't solve 100% of the problem. But we ought to put everything on the table and see if there are places where we can agree, because we owe it to our kids and our grandkids to leave them a fiscal house that is somewhat in order and is not in complete disarray, which is exactly what we're going to do if we don't confront this problem.
Andrea gets to say what her husband meant to say. No, what's your question, Andrea? And then Fred will be the last.
You suggested that you put North Korea on the agenda with the Axis of Evil speech. Some people might suggest it was their missile firing that really got the world's attention and their misbehavior.
But last week's missile firing? I think the diplomacy that's been involved in this has been taking more than a week.
I'll repeat it just when you get to the question mark. Yeah.
Let me ask you whether you think it would have been easier to deal with Iran without demonizing them with the Axis of Evil speech when oil wasn't what if now is paying the Iranians when they weren't as far along in their nuclear research program, and whether there was a different government with which we might have dealt.
So you want this on Iran, not North Korea. The question is, demonizing Iran by putting them in the axis of evil, could we have dealt with them better earlier without demonizing them when oil was lower and when they had a different government?
That may be the way some would, but this president believes in speaking with clarity, and they are part of the axis of evil. They support their state sponsor of terrorism. They have long-held and long-pursued nuclear ambitions. They have ambitions for the complete and utter destruction of Israel under the so-called moderate predecessor regime. They had the same objective. So this president was absolutely right when he said to the world community, we need to deal with Iran with clear-eyed realism about what they're about and what they're doing. And it may be nice to sort of say, we know you're really bad, but we're not going to say that you're bad because we don't want to offend you and don't want to cause others to recognize they have hard decisions to make. But if we had not designated them as the part of the axis of evil and North Korea as the part of the axis of evil, nobody else in the world would be willing to deal with them or be concerned about them. I've been to these international conferences. I mean, whether it is Darfur, Sudan, North Korea, Iran, it is the United States of America, AIDS in Africa, that is putting things on the agenda, and not the world community rushing to offer them up.
Fred's going to have the last question, but you mentioned Darfur. A lot of comment here about it. Do you think the administration is doing enough, and what more are you planning to do if it continues?
Yeah, well, it will continue until they abide by their agreements. But we've sent Danforth as a special envoy, Zelik as a special envoy. We have obviously brokered the agreement in the South, which is much better shape than it was when we came into office. The central regime has responded in the West by, in essence, legitimizing the militias. We have, in May, gotten them to assign an agreement that says that they will actively move to disband the militias, to integrate certain components of some of the sort of groups in the South on all sides into the National Army, and that they will allow the African Union to come in and serve as peacekeepers. We're providing the muscle to get them in, fly them in. We're providing the muscle and the money to pay for them. We've asked for it to be moved from an African Union mission to a UN mission. The UN has been reluctant to do so. We think, you know, the African Union, as well-intentioned as they are, does simply not have the sophistication and the wherewithal as the United Nations can bring to bear on this. This has been an issue that is of a personal and deep concern of the president. He has met frequently with refugees from Sudan and from Darfur. He prevailed upon Jack Danforth to come back into government, who did a magnificent job in getting the first agreement. We're keeping this on. This will be an issue that he will raise at the G8 next week, and we will continue to raise with the United Nations. It is frankly beyond comprehension why, with the obvious suffering and the obvious, you know, disaster in Darfur, that the United Nations cannot be brought in to do what it needs to do, and that we're left with a well-intentioned but clearly inadequate mission on behalf of the African Union.
Fred Malik, last question.
Well, first, thank you for an amazingly broad and comprehensive discussion. The one thing we haven't talked about, though, is immigration. The president has taken a firm but compassionate approach to immigration reform. It's chaired by leading members of the United States Senate, including the majority of both Democrats and Republicans. This seems to have resistance in the House. I wonder if you could comment on the policy and what you see as the outcome.
And even mentioned, I think you're going Tuesday to La Raza, the Hispanic group, so you're going to have a lot of questions. The question was immigration. The president has come out with what was called a compassionate, moderate approach. He's having trouble getting it through the House, but the Senate has been good. Carl is about to leave here, I think, Tuesday to speak to La Raza, where this is the big cause. I know that Carl personally and the president personally have been very dedicated to a comprehensive immigration solution, but the politics is difficult.
I am going Tuesday to speak to La Raza, and in preparation for my speech, I went into the White House library. In the White House itself, there's a library on the first floor, and not too often used, but I went there in order to retrieve two volumes that I knew would provide great inspiration to me as I prepared my remarks for La Raza. It's the two most important volumes to be found in the entire White House library. I've never seen it anywhere else. I'm deeply moved that the volumes are there. I drank deeply from the springs, and I'm sure La Raza is looking forward to me sharing with them the brilliant insights that I gleaned from dipping into the two-volume history of Norwegian immigration to America, published in 1936, as the highest-ranking Norwegian-American in the White House. Hell is the only Norwegian-American in the White House. I thought it would be useful to share. No, immigration. Look, this is a big issue, and we have an issue with Republicans in the House, some Republicans on the House. Let me just say, the newspapers are going to be prone to write this up as, you know, sort of dead on arrival, no activity, but I'm really amazed at the amount of very positive activity that is going on behind the scenes between Senator Specter, who will chair the conference committee, and Congressman Sensenbrenner of the House, who will lead the House conferees if and when they're ever appointed. They're not likely to be appointed soon because once the House conferees are appointed, 20 days after that, the House can begin to instruct them. So the object is to have the leaders of the two conferences talk and come to an agreement and then name the conferees once they get to the final stages. But there's lots of positive conversation going on there about a comprehensive solution. And look, we need to deal with this in a comprehensive way because the system is absolutely broken. And we better solve it in a comprehensive fashion or there is no real solution available. For example, look, we're doing a lot more to control our borders. You would be shocked. How many people do you think we have stopped at the border and returned since 2001? Anyone want to hazard a guess? 200,000? Anybody higher? 1.3 million. Anybody higher? 5 million. You're getting close. 6 million people since 2001. Susan's got the number for the last year, which is about 1.3 million, 1.4 million. So we're getting better at the border. In fact, we're trying a lot of things on the border. About 85% of the people who come across the border come from Mexico. And what we used to do is you come across the border at Laredo, and we take you back across the border at Nuevo Laredo and say, hey, you're stuck, go back to Mexico. We'll drop you back across the border. Every bit of evidence is that the recidivism among those people is at least 30 to 40%. That is to say, if we catch somebody, the odds are that that 30 to 40%, we've caught them before. The Border Patrol, they're hard-nosed guys. In the Laredo division of the Laredo sector of the border, they've made a determination. They've did a cost-benefit analysis. If we get somebody coming across the border, how many times do they have to come across the border before we put them in a cell, charge them with an immigration violation, assign a deputy U.S. attorney to prosecute them, put them in front of a federal magistrate or a federal judge, and then put them in the jail and then return them to Mexico? You know what their answer was? 8 times. So what we did is we said, how can we break this cycle of people just coming and throwing themselves against the border time and time and time and time again until they get across? And we tried 2 experiments. The first one was lateral repatriation. If we picked you up in Laredo, we flew you to San Diego and dropped you off across the border in Tijuana. If we picked you up in San Diego, we flew you to Laughlin Air Force Base in Del Rio, Texas, and dropped you across the border at Piedras Negras. And what we found was that the recidivism rate dropped by at least half, maybe more. But we also found out that anecdotally, bad things were happening on both sides of the border. These people being dropped 1,000 miles or 1,200 miles from where their support system was, where their coyote was, the guy who they paid to get them across the border, they were so desperate that they engaged in criminal activity on both sides of the border just to stay alive. So we tried another thing called interior repatriation. For a 2-week period last year, there were 80,000 Mexicans that we grabbed at the border. And we said, look, we can drop you back across the border at here. We got you at Laredo. We'll drop you back across the border at Nuevo Laredo. But we looked at your papers here, and we recognize that you're from a little town deep inside Mexico. So how about this? You voluntarily agree to be repatriated to your hometown. We'll fly you to Mexico City and put you on a bus to your dusty little city. How does that sound to you? 24,000 of those people accepted interior repatriation. They had to do it voluntarily. The recidivism rate among those people is potentially no more than a quarter of the recidivism rate for the people that get treated in the traditional way. Now, that's going to take a lot of money and some changed agreements with Mexico in order to repatriate those people. Another example, 15% of the people that we get that come across the border illegally do not come from Mexico. They're called Other Than Mexicans, OTMs. And we've had for several decades, your government has had a policy of so-called catch and release. It's not the same as you get on the Roaring Fork. Well, actually, it sort of is. You catch him and you let him go. And you give him a little piece of paper and you say, here's your court date. We don't have enough facilities. If you're a criminal, we'll hold you. If you're committed a crime here or in your home country, we're going to put you in jail. But if you didn't, we're going to release you on your own recognizance. Here's your little slip that tells you when to show up for your court date. And guess what? 92% of them don't show up. I'm not certain we want the 8% that did. Now, what we did is we said, okay, we're going to have a zero-tolerance policy. And we're going to start by picking out some visible groups, like the Brazilians. So we said, we're going to get every Brazilian who comes across the border, their point of entry is Texas. When you come across the border in Texas, and frankly anywhere else, but starting in Texas, we're going to have zero tolerance. So what we're going to do is we're going to put you through a process where we take whatever amount of resources are necessary to hold you, process you, and put you back on the plane to Rio as quickly as we can. And we did this program last year. 6 weeks after we started, in Brazil, they call that little slip that you got for your court date, they called it a permiso, a permission slip. So we did this, and what happened is, 6 weeks later, apprehensions of Brazilians dropped by 90%. And we also got the Mexicans to agree to close their southern border because they had a visa waiver program for Brazilians who were coming across the border without a visa and then coming north and getting in the United States. Now, we're doing the darndest things you could ever imagine to resolve the problem of under the Mexicans. We have with one Central American company a secure video link in their capital city and a secure video link here in the United States. We catch one of their nationals coming across the border. We arrange to take them to that facility. We have a video link. We have the consular officials and the U.S. officials conduct the interview in front of the video link, fax the papers to the U.S., and we put them on the next available plane. When we came into office, an other than Mexican was being held in a U.S. facility for 90 days. They're now being held in a U.S. facility for 22 days. In fact, we look at these numbers every week. Let me give you the last numbers. I just happened to notice because this is one of my sort of pet peeves. 3 weeks ago, we got roughly 2,700 other than Mexicans apprehended in the United States. As of today, 1,600 of them are gone. Of the remaining 1,100 of them, 976 are from El Salvador. And we are, because of a court decision, not allowed to return them to El Salvador. The court decision dates from the time when there was a brutal civil war going on in El Salvador, and a Ninth Circuit judge held that we could not return them to El Salvador because of a brutal civil war. Guess what? No civil war. We're trying to get that Congress to pass a specific piece of legislation to allow us to return the Salvadorians. But there are 976 of the 1,100 people we got. The next largest group is the People's Republic of China, and there were 40-some odd of them. We sent the Secretary of Homeland Security to China twice. The President raised the issue with Hu Jintao in China, raised it with him here. We finally got the Chinese People's Republic to agree to begin receiving back that modest number of people. The rest, less than 100 people, or just over 100 people, excuse me, were people that we did not consider to be a flight risk and might be potential real asylum questions. My point is not to dwell too much on, but we're working hard on getting control of the borders. But we cannot get control of our borders until we do something about allowing a man or a woman who is making 50 cents an hour in Mexico and can make 10 bucks an hour in the United States for a job that Americans will not do. Until we have a system that allows them to come here, we don't have enough people to stand across the bottom of the border and stop them. We just don't. And we've got to have a temporary worker program that allows people to come here for a reasonable period of time. Every bit of evidence we have is that people do not come here in order to stay in America. People coming across the border illegally. We do know the people who come here legally and visa overstay, they probably have a different attitude. And one-third of the people who are here illegally today come on a visa and overstay. But the people coming across the Mexican border, in principle, don't come here with the expectation of staying. They want to come up here and get together and nest egg and go home. But we're making it so difficult to get here that what happens is they get here. 1990, you could pay a coyote $100 to get across the border. You know what the price is today? $1,500 to $2,000. That's getting that much more difficult to get across the border. So you scrape together the money to get across the border. You get across the border. You get a job. Dad dies. You can't go home. Too tough to get back and forth. Little sister gets married. Can't go home. Too difficult to get back across the border. Little brother graduates from high school, can't go home for holidays, can't go home for family. You wake up, you've been here for 5 or 10 years, and you say, I got no connection to that dusty little town in the interior of Mexico, I'm staying. Who should be surprised at that? What we ought to have is a system that allows them to keep those personal connections, to travel back and forth across the border freely during a time that they're in the United States legally. We also need to do something about the visa overstays. People cannot come here and overstay their visa and break the law. And that's going to mean that we're going to have to get tougher on interior enforcement so that employers have a system by which they can check to see if somebody is here legally. And it's easy to do and gives them a safe harbor from being sued. And we've got to do something to deal with the issue of the people who have been here for a long time. Now, I don't know how many of them there are. The Pew Charitable Trust says there are 12.5 million. Homeland Security says there are 10.5 million. I don't know how many there are. But I know we cannot say to them, get the hell out of here. First of all, we know one thing about them. Their work participation is as good as the rest of the American population. So these people are working in jobs. Let's say that 8 million of them are here working. And we, out of the 10.5 million, and we say, get out of here, what's going to happen to our economy? And second of all, you know, I've started to keep a file. Because I go meet with the Texas delegation. You talk about hard asses on immigration. You go meet with the Texas Republican congressional delegation and get your ass chewed on for a while. I take a file. I've been collecting a file to take with me, though. A file of stories about people who are here illegally who've done something. The kid who graduates from Princeton and wants to go study at Oxford and can't because he's here illegally. You know, the valedictorian or the salutatorian of the high school class who's the son or daughter of an illegal alien. The guy who rescues the family, the kids from the burning house, who's the illegal alien. We've got to, in a compassionate, caring way, say to people, okay, you got here in the wrong way, so you got to pay a penalty. Amnesty is giving somebody something, a free pardon without penalty, so there's got to be a penalty. You got to pay a fine. You got to be able to demonstrate you've been here. You've got to be able to demonstrate you kept your nose clean. But if you then want to become a U.S. citizen, you ought to be able to, as long as you go to the back of the line. You don't, your presence here, be able to get ahead of the people who have been waiting back in their home country in a legal fashion. But we better do something about this in a caring or compassionate way, or we're going to wake up and we're going to find that our country has lost something really vital and important to it. Can I say one more thing on this? Let me say one more thing. There are a lot of really good people who are scared to death about immigration. And we shouldn't be surprised about it. First of all, because it always happens. I've been reading a sort of the pre-Civil War history. And, boy, talk about, you know, the Mexicans of those days were the Irish. I read some of the comments, and I'm serious, I did. There is a two-volume history, two-volume history of Norwegian immigration to America. You should hear what politicians in the Midwest said about we Norwegians when we were coming. Root eaters. I mean, you know, they didn't like us. This happens, and I understand that. But there's also something with which we do have to deal, and that is we are a great country and have been able to assimilate people from all kinds of backgrounds and all parts of the world because we've emphasized a shared language, a common tradition, an understanding of what it is. Look, with all due respect, there's no Filipino dream. There's no Japanese dream. There's no Italian dream, but there is an American dream. And some guy standing on a street corner in Addis Ababa knows what it's about. It's being able to come here and dream big and work hard and get what you want and have a good life for your family because you've done the right thing. And we've got to, as we solve this problem, we've got to think about assimilation. I was meeting with Cardinal Mahoney about this, and we were talking about how can we build into a comprehensive solution requirements and systems that allow us to have confidence that we're going to assimilate people. And we can. We've done it before. I don't care whether it's the Russian Jew fleeing the pogrom or the Italian immigrant, the Irish dying from potatoes, and the Norwegian sick and tired of eating cod. I mean, we do it. And we can do it again, but it's got to be part of this if we're going to have people at the end of this process say, you know what, I may not like some element of this or some element of that, but overall, when this gets all finished, America's still going to be America, and we're going to be okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you. That was unbelievable. Really good.